This is Your Call. I'm Angie Quero in for Rose Aguilar. Today, we continue our series on the Trump administration's capture, detainment, and deportment of countless immigrants. They're purported to be here illegally, but multiple agencies, including Newsweek and NBC, have reported both U.S. citizens and immigrants here legally have also been detained. The images conjured up by the phrase border patrols may be dated. It's more than troops in camouflage or all black, heavily armed, scouring the desert, or searchlights from guard towers flickering along the desert. Today, much of the war on immigrants is almost invisible. Drones determining patrol placement are as far as 2 miles overhead. Predictive technology determining people's fates are when they are apprehended, and AI powering lie detectors deciding whether asylum seekers are telling the truth. The New York Times, reviewing nearly 15,000 contracts, found that two agencies, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and Citizen and Immigration Services, have spent almost $8 billion on immigration technology since 2020. That money has gone to 263 tech companies. The tech immigration partnership is not limited to one political party, nor is it limited to the United States. But Trump at the helm here may mean an even bigger bonanza for the merchants, with less reflection on ethical considerations. Today, we'll learn what's happening on the ground in our cities and how federal agencies are using even more militarized technology at the U.S. borders and in sanctuary cities. Petra Molnar is a lawyer and anthropologist specializing in migration and human rights. She's associate director of the Refugee Law Lab at York University. And she's the author of The Walls Have Eyes, Surviving Migration in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. Right on point. Petra, welcome to Your Call.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm glad to have you. Alejandro Ruiz Esparza is also on the line. They are co-director of the Lucy Parsons Lab in Chicago. Lucy Parsons brings together data scientists, transparency activists, artists, and technologists to work on digital rights and on the streets issues. Ale has worked on the campaigns around biometrics. They've educated criminalized populations, elected officials, journalists, and community groups about government use of technology. Ale, welcome.
Thank you so much, Angie. Glad to be here.
I'm really glad to have you here. In fact, we'll start with you. We heard even before Trump took office that Chicago was going to be the first big target for ICE, targeting undocumented people. So what's been happening on the ground there in the past week, or in terms of law enforcement and resistance, what's happening there now?
Yeah, thank you so much, Angie. I think that's a great question. A lot has been happening. I think that's safe to say.
Yeah.
There has been, I think, an increase in fear and paranoia. I think that's been a big part of just how the sort of vibe in the city has changed. I think as a result, unfortunately, we've started seeing things like, kids are often not going to school. Some folks aren't going to work because there is more fear of these deportations happening. My parents are Mexican immigrants, and a lot of what I've seen in my own community back home has just reflected this as well. But with all of that sort of increase in this fear and this pervasive chill, I think there's also just been a very powerful emergent set of collective defense, a lot of mutual aid, and just like deepening of community relations. Mm-hmm. And I think I can really just break it down in three ways. I think there are sort of three layers. One that's maybe more publicly visible and more formal, and two that get less visible, less formal. But at the very top, the most visible and the most formal layer of on-the-ground response has been this sort of coordination that's happened with groups like the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, or ICER, and Organized Communities Against Deportation, or OCAD. These are groups that have set up and coordinated a lot of hotlines for reporting ICE and DHS. They've also worked with various community groups to expand Know Your Rights trainings, which has been something we've seen very frequently across the city, especially in the past 2 weeks. And then alongside that, you know, very visible, very sort of formal layer, we've seen a lot of autonomous and emergent rapid response groups, usually at the community level. Mm-hmm. So these are sets of volunteers who do a lot of the day-to-day work, fact-checking when reports of ICE and DHS are being called in. They do a lot of canvassing and flyering in the early morning up until night. A lot of counter-patrolling. These groups are largely self-organized, and they've been expanding through a lot of person-to-person interaction. So you've seen that kind of relational development happen at the level of just people talking to each other on the streets. Mm-hmm. And I think in the last week especially, one thing we've seen is that these sort of self-organized nodes that have just popped up across the entirety of the city have started also just developing deeper lines of communication laterally with each other. So communication is being disseminated a lot faster. I actually think in a lot of ways it parallels what we saw in the lockdown, where we saw an unfortunately glaring absence of city support get filled primarily with these autonomous mutual aid groups and existing nonprofits. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did some work with some folks in a neighborhood on the north side called Rogers Park. So there's two groups there, Red Rogers Park and Protect RP, that have been doing a lot of work. And there's just so many of these across the city right now. And I think the lowest, I guess the least visible layer, the least formal layer, are these whisper networks that just organically appear within communities. These are like, you know, people that like my parents know, that like our community members know, that join into WhatsApp groups together. They communicate information really rapidly. They disseminate things in various languages amongst each other. And I think it's been excellent to see how effective, at least in this initial stage, these kinds of very, you know, just organic formations have been at curtailing some of these federal arrests. I mean, at this point, Chicago's had at least 100 federal arrests, but you have, you know, these people like Tom Homan, who's called the border czar by the Trump administration, decrying Chicago's population as being very well educated. And, you know, I think what he had also said was that they call these know your rights trainings, but what Tom Homan calls them is escape from ICE, which is just a ridiculous thing to say.
Oh, Lord.
yeah, it's just it's absolutely abysmal. But I think, you know, it's a testament to how quickly the city has just been able to collect and develop these communal responses.
And, you know, I want to go over to Petra here because I want to bring her in with the same questions along the border. Petra, before we get into technology per se, what's the larger picture of what's been happening there since January 20th? How active is the border in terms of arrests, in terms of patrols? Are there more people on the job there? What's happening?
There's definitely been an intensification of a lot of the policies that were already happening at the border. I mean, in your introduction, you mentioned militarization or bringing in the military, whether that's in terms of technology, but also just personnel, more people to the border, increasing arrests, ripping apart communities and families. I mean, this, again, has been on an exponential trajectory since the inauguration. And you know, I mean, none of it is perhaps surprising given the kind of messaging that was already there during the election season and then in post-election. But I think for a lot of us who are working in the sector, the sheer scale of what is happening and the speed with which it's happening is definitely terrifying.
You know, I want to bring out some context here that I want to be careful that we're not saying immigration enforcement is bad. The Border Patrol is bad. People on the job, ICE is bad. We don't want to paint with that broader brush. So let me put this in this context. And Petra, I'll start with you. We have immigration laws. Authorities are using the most cutting edge effective technology to enforce the laws. Where's the problem there?
Well, one of the problems that I think border technologies highlight is just how little oversight and accountability there really is at the border. So border spaces have historically been these zones of opacity, of discretion, of oftentimes not really being able to tell what is happening and what kind of decisions get made. And then when you introduce technologies into the mix, technologies that are oftentimes untested, very high risk, sometimes military grade, what that does to the kind of human rights framework is that it muddies the water even more, because we're talking about a context where the individual impact on people's rights is very, very high. We're talking about detention, deportation, sometimes even loss of life. And yet we are seeing again this kind of importation of new tech, new surveillance, new types of tools without really having a robust framework in place through which we can hold actors accountable. Transparency, for example, also is lacking, not to mention a robust assessment of the human rights impacts that these technologies are having. That's one of the major criticisms that a lot of us have been raising for years in this kind of obsession with introducing more technology at the border.
In fact, in a piece you wrote for Tech Policy Press, you used a phrase that just stopped me in my tracks. You said surveillance and death go hand in hand. Can you go into that a little bit, how the use of tech at the border leaves you with that impression?
Sure. And this impression is based on not only my personal experiences at the border as a lawyer and researcher, but also interviews that I've been doing for the last number of years with people on the move and also people who are working with mobile communities at the border. Again, when surveillance technologies are introduced without any kind of conversation about human rights and impacts and the kind of accountability that needs to be there, the sharpest manifestation is that surveillance can actually increase loss of life at the border. By this, I mean, through the introduction of surveillance technology at the border, there has been a documented exponential increase of loss of life at the US-Mexico frontier. Because essentially, what surveillance technologies are doing is they're becoming a dragnet that is ensnaring people who are exercising their internationally protected right to asylum and coming into the United States through the corridor between Mexico and the US. And oftentimes, these surveillance technologies are introduced by states under the guise of strengthening the border system and preventing people from coming. So the more surveillance there is, less people are going to come. Except that doesn't actually work in practice this way. What surveillance does is it forces people into less inhabited terrain, so taking riskier routes through the desert. And this is exactly what leads to the loss of life that has been documented, a nearly threefold increase since the introduction of smart border technologies at the US-Mexico corridor.
Wow. We're going to get into that technology heavily, but Alejandro, I want to give you the same opportunity to talk about the context in which the tech is being used in Chicago that makes this unfair or makes it dangerous. Essentially, I'm asking you the same question about what's going wrong with enforcing a law that is now in effect. How are they doing that wrong?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I want to extend a lot of what Petra is saying. There's this sort of a false narrative of criminalization and efficacy. We're not, you don't actually really see a significant reduction in migration. What you end up seeing is more of these cruel acts that just increase loss of life. I think there's this expanding securitization practice that just continually changes the sort of the changes the subject, in this case a migrant, into a larger and larger security threat in order to just follow these kinds of state policies that we've been seeing enacted. At least in Chicago, we've seen that there are various kinds of guardrails that get put up to prevent to try to keep these new surveillance devices in line with existing laws, but they're just ineffective. In general, Chicago is one of a couple of sanctuary cities across the US. And ideally, that sort of law is supposed to do things like prevent the sharing of data between the Chicago Police Department or the municipal police departments with these federal agents, as well as prevent the city from collecting any kind of demographic information that might be related to immigration status. But in practice, this doesn't happen. Oftentimes, we see ICE, Department of Homeland Security, and so forth. They just go around these existing laws by doing things like purchasing data directly from data brokers. They find ways of picking up multiple people at one time through collateral arrests, often doing things like issuing what are called 1509 custom summons, which sort of gives DHS and ICE this excuse of like, Like we're here to look and see if the store is selling like counterfeit merchandise, for example, and use that as an excuse to end up actually just doing a raid and collecting a bunch of people at one time. In general, I think the reality of the situation is that we have some sorts of guardrails in place. This new sort of I guess acceleration or this amplification of existing ICE and DHS behavior has just produced situations in which laws that are meant to keep people's civil liberties intact are fundamentally just they're just avoided. And often we also just see that even situations in which you could imagine data is held by municipal bodies just freely given up. Often we see that police officers just give the data to ICE regardless, not just in Chicago, but in other similar places. Like we've seen this in California very often.
I want to ask you about the way that you're organizing. And of course, surveillance is going to be critical, is critical for people who are opposing the law, opposing the raids. And you mentioned that people who are working in resistance are already using WhatsApp, which is a secure network, but is also owned by Meta, which you don't know what direction Meta is going to go at any point in making that a truly secure app. And I wonder how much consideration that people at the Lucy Parsons Lab and people in the other activists group, how are they communicating so as best to keep it private?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think these encrypted apps like Signal and Meta or Signal and WhatsApp have been pretty present in Chicago, definitely within LPL as well as within broader organizing. But I think, you know, I think it'd be a mistake to take this sort of techno-solutionist approach and just assume that if we have a good encrypted tool, it's going to keep us safe. I think the best approach, something that we've seen a lot in Chicago too, is we're trying to have a broader understanding of what a relationship to technology is to begin with, and understand that tools like Signal, tools like WhatsApp, at least at this moment, could provide some limited protections to our communications with each other. Mm-hmm. But there are just, you know, there are some things that are better said in person. I think we have to reorient our communication to be very deeply relational and happen with trusted individuals. I think in short, we do see that Signal, WhatsApp, and so forth are used very frequently. I think it's not too surprising to also see that frequently groups like NSA and other federal bodies try to lobby these pieces of litigation against companies like Signal.
Mm-hmm. Petra, let's talk about some of the technology that's happening at the border that people might be surprised to see. And I have to focus on those robo-dogs. They're essentially robots. They have the basic body structure of a dog. They don't have a head or a tail. They've got a distinctive way of moving. They're sort of apocalyptic looking. And you've asked people to imagine having one of them running up to you at the border. So what exactly are they being used for there?
Yeah, the robo-dog, that's something that really captures the imagination. And unfortunately, it's not really just in the imagination anymore or a sci-fi show like The Black Mirror, but it has become a reality at the border. I think this is probably one of the more visceral examples of technology that has made its way into the kind of surveillance paradigm that we're talking about today. Essentially, a robo-dog is exactly what you're describing, Angie. It's a four-legged, quadruped, military-grade piece of technology. You know, listeners might have seen these kind of robo-dogs on YouTube if you're looking, for example, you know, at latest innovations, and this kind of ambling form is seen there. Essentially, they were introduced in February of 2022 by the Department of Homeland Security in a public press release, which is still available, that kind of proudly unveiled this latest innovation to be joining this, you know, arsenal of border technologies. Again, they have been used in military applications before. They can be armed, and they are joining the kind of tools that are already present at the border. But they're also just one part of this broader class of technologies that we're seeing at the border. You know, this includes drones that extend the border vertically into the sky. There is thermal cameras. There's different types of surveillance, such as AI-powered towers that are dotted throughout the Sonora Desert, for example. But there's also technologies that are more difficult to see that are also part of this paradigm. There's things like social media scraping and monitoring of your behavior online before you even move. There is other kind of outlandish sci-fi seeming projects like AI lie detectors that were being tested out in the European Union, or visa triaging algorithms, which Canada was using. Again, it makes up this kind of broader panopticon of technologies that essentially impact a person's migration journey from start to finish.
When you talk about the AI lie detectors, it sounds like that's one of the things that is used after someone has been apprehended. A lot of this comes down to surveillance, finding people. What about the interpersonal exchange when a border agent finds someone who is trying to cross into the country? What else besides the AI lie detector fits in technologically? What other technology is being used there?
And I think kind of trying to pay attention to some of the sociological impacts of technology, something that Ale was reminding us of as well, is really, really important, because so much of what is happening is about these broader framings of assuming that a person on the move is somehow a threat, a fraud, a terrorist, somebody to be arrested and removed. And so it starts kind of making sense if that is the framing and migration is being seen as a quote-unquote problem. Then the technologies that are introduced become the solution. And that's how we end up with things like AI lie detectors. That's how we end up with facial recognition technology for identification purposes, and other types of projects that law enforcement has been piloting and testing out. But again, it is about these kind of broader framings. And I think it also maybe begs the question, like, what is this really doing to the kind of human-to-human interaction that is already very, very difficult, and very, very charged in spaces like the border, because there are vast power differentials, right, that are inherent between law enforcement and border enforcement, and the person that is feeling this kind of brunt of state power. And technologies just exacerbate that, right? They become tools that get weaponized towards mobile communities and other vulnerable communities as well. They're definitely not neutral in any way, shape, or form.
Petra Molnar is the author of The Walls Have Eyes: Surviving Migration in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. Also talking with Ale Ruiz Esparza with the Lucy Parsons Lab in Chicago, and our conversation is all about technology in the enforcement of the ICE raids under the Trump administration. I'm Angie Correa, sitting here for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call, and at this point, we'd like to open up our phone lines and our email to you to get your contributions to our hour. You're more than welcome to join the conversation at 866-798-TALK or 866-798-8255. Our email for your off-air contributions is yourcall@kalw.org. Specifically, what are your concerns about the technology we're discussing? Do you feel from our conversation and from other conversations you heard that it is being used inappropriately? Are you confident that it will continue to be used appropriately as the situation develops? Do you think there should be more oversight or perhaps limitations on private profits from government contracts for the tech? Or should that be an unlimited open market to bring the best tech to the fore in the enforcement of immigration laws in the U.S.? All of that is on the table, plus any other aspect of what we're talking about. 866-798-8255 is the phone number. Our email is yourcall@kalw.org. This is Your Call. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Your Call. I'm Angie Correa in for Rose Aguilar. Our episodes are available on our podcast page at kalw.org/yourcall. If you've missed any portion of this conversation, it will be posted right after the show. While you're there, sign up for our newsletter. If you have a show idea for us, you can use the call-in line and our email. The call-in, 866-798-TALK. Email is yourcall@kalw.org. Petra, before we went to the break, you mentioned facial recognition, and that's been problematic in the past in that we've already seen that there are racial disparities in how accurate it is and how it's being used for enforcement. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, that's such an important point, and this is something that scholars like Ruha Benjamin and Sophia Noble have been pushing for many, many years. This understanding that, again, technology is not neutral, and facial recognition in particular has been racially discriminating for years since its inception. Essentially, all technology, because it's a social construct, relies on the way that our world is today, right? And knowing, of course, that there are so many ways that we can discriminate against one another. If there's biased data that's going into a facial recognition system, it might end up with biased results. And that's exactly what's been proven again and again. And in the border context, paying attention to these discriminatory ways that facial recognition technology can be used is very, very crucial, because again, the decisions that it renders can be life or death sometimes, or in particular instances, a person might not be let into the country to be able to reunite with their family or claim asylum if a facial recognition system makes a mistake and is discriminatory. So, I think in these instances, again, it's about the tech, but it's also about the broader societal context in which the technology is developed and deployed.
And Ali, I'm sure that's the way it's playing out in Chicago as well. I want to look at an article that you wrote last year in The Progressive, and I'm quoting here. Under the Trump administration, and to clarify, that's the first administration, ICE launched a surveillance-driven attack on sanctuary cities, including Chicago, under Operation Palladium. Data sharing between federal and municipal agencies provided ICE with warrantless access to sources like the city's error-ridden gang database. Today, ICE still bypasses the sanctuary ordinance to surveil, detain, and displace Chicago immigrants to out-of-state jails while using new digital tools to expand its monitoring capabilities. So you wrote that in 2024. With the raids underway, has anything with that changed? Has it expanded? What's going on there?
Yeah, thank you. So I think there's a number of things. One is while the gang database currently no longer exists in Chicago, there are still similar existing criminalizing and administrative databases that do. An unfortunate reality that we've seen play out in the last 2 weeks is extreme lack of information from the mayor's office, the city government at large, around what information is actually being accessed by ICE in any given moment. But one thing we do know is that ICE has been able to leverage data brokers in particular, like LexisNexis or Thomson Reuters, to get information around Cook County detainments up to 15 minutes after people have been released. So they are still leveraging these existing kinds of databases, these kinds of databases that otherwise would have required a warrant to get any sort of access. And they're doing it because they can just purchase the data, right? Like, there unfortunately aren't any kinds of useful regulations with teeth that prevent the transfer of data that otherwise would require a warrant within sanctuary cities. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see them leveraging other kinds of city databases. There hasn't been as good communication as one would like from some of these actors, like the mayor's office. I think, in short, we see this behavior constantly. They just buy their way through existing laws, because these laws don't have effective regulations that prevent the transfer of data.
You mentioned a little bit before about how much pushback there is from city authorities. Can you delve into that a little bit? I'm thinking about Chicago's status as a sanctuary city, how much it's being defended there. In San Francisco, it's being fairly strongly defended. What's happening there in terms of the city officials and county officials standing up to the federal officials?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag, I have to say. I think in a lot of ways, sanctuary city ordinances, they provide limited protections. I think I just spoke a bit to some of the weaknesses, especially when it comes to the transfer of data and information.
Right.
But I think what's unfortunate is we have seen quite a number of sort of bombastic alder people here in the city. There's this one alderman, Raymond Lopez, another one, Silvana Tabarez, who have been trying desperately for the past year or so to actually remove the welcoming city ordinance, as well as invite new surveillance, smaller surveillance groups into the city, and try to install some of their products. I think there is this, internal division that does exist. But overall, I think what's been more frustrating than anything is that there's this kind of city level posturing that we have this ordinance, we have to keep it, and there just is not enough work on strengthening what we already have. If these loopholes still exist, then the ordinance isn't going to protect people in the way that the city would like. At the bare minimum, there shouldn't be any capability for these federal agencies to just purchase their way into this data with this sort of data that otherwise requires a warrant. And at best, we really should have better practices towards what gets called data minimization. The city should be collecting less data, not more, and definitely not more that they're just going to integrate in these systems with private sector surveillance groups that end up just selling it back to other federal agencies.
Let me go back to you, Petra, and I want to refer back to that tech policy article that you wrote. You made an important point that neither President Obama nor Biden, neither was exempt from critique here. And to quote you, much of the expansion of surveillance occurred under the Obama and Biden administrations, with the Democrats presenting, quote, smart borders as a more humane alternative to walls and cages. All right, let's start there, and then we'll bring Trump into the picture. What was the effect of the smart borders? What did that look like, and what happened?
Yeah, and thanks for bringing this up, Angie, because it's so important to not be ahistorical in this very real moment of crisis, because so much of what's happening today is predated by policies that were oftentimes introduced by Democratic administrations. So there was this push to strengthen the so-called smart border regime under the Obama administration and the Biden administration through the introduction of different types of technologies, some of which we were already talking about, right? The drones, the cameras, the AI-powered towers, the robodogs, all of it kind of becoming part of the system of surveillance that was presented publicly as a humane alternative to a wall and like a physical barrier. But again, as we were already talking about, right? Surveillance is insidious because it casts dragnet that catches people in equally difficult ways and actually leads to loss of life at the US-Mexico border and in other spaces as well. So we have to critique just how humane, quote unquote, these policies really were.
So let me, using that information, help me parse this out. Trump said he wants to, quote, terminate every open border policy of the Biden administration and immediately restore the full set of strong Trump border policies. How bombastic is that distinction that he's making? And secondary to that, what new technology is he hoping or planning to bring online during his term that would differ from what they were using?
Well, I guess to start off with, these distinctions that are being made are actually perhaps not as bombastic as they appear, right? Knowing what was actually happening during Democratic administrations too. However, there has been this exponential increase in messaging around new technology, more surveillance, more military at the border, ramping up of deportations. So much of that is already happening. So again, I think it is important to recognize that this moment in time in particular is something to be really vigilant about when it comes to the introduction of new technologies. Now, what types of tools might be brought in? It's a bit hard to speculate, but I think it's fair to say, given the trends in other countries around the world as well, that we are likely going to be seeing more automation, more reliance on artificial intelligence and algorithmic decision making, for example, but also just pumping more money into what has become a border industrial complex that is really worth billions and billions of dollars now. So it's also about the kind of industry and the role of the private sector in all of this. That is such an important element that we are definitely seeing more and more of since the January inauguration.
And that takes us into the whole concept of people who are making money on the ICE raids, on the detentions, on the deportations. I'm wondering if you have access, who knows what's accessible anymore under the government because .gov pages are disappearing every day. Do you have some insight into whether the spending has accelerated under the Trump, what it's who it's being expanded to, who's making more money off of this? There's the GEO group and that's operating some 50 detention and residential facilities. There's Clearview AI, facial recognition, as we discussed. That's been sued by immigrants' rights groups. And then there's Boeing and an Israeli firm, Elbit Systems. Tell me how they're all taking part in this and whether they're looking at fattened paychecks now or in the near future.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a statistic that went out there that the day after Donald Trump was reelected, stocks in private prison firms soared, right? And we are seeing this expansion, again, of this industry that has grown up around the quote-unquote problem of migration. And, you know, there are the big players that you mentioned, the Palantir, the Clearview AI, you know, the kind of big tech companies that maybe listeners are aware of, but there's also a host of small and medium-sized companies that are kind of jostling for power, again, in this kind of economy. So we're definitely going to be seeing more and more of that. And also international companies like Israelis, Elbit Systems, for example, they are already present in the U.S. Marketplace. Because ultimately that is what it is. It's money talks in this industry, and that is ultimately where power operates as well. By that I mean, you know, sometimes it can be difficult to kind of understand like how we actually got here. How is it possible that there are robo-dogs and AI lie detectors? But it perhaps starts making sense when we pay attention to who the power brokers in the conversation are. And then it's not an accident that we are seeing drones and thermal cameras and robo-dogs and AI lie detectors that are weaponized against people on the move and not using AI, for example, to identify racist border guards or to audit immigration decision makers. Mm-hmm. Like that's a clear normative choice that a powerful set of actors is making, and they're also making a lot of money off of it.
Yeah, I actually saw someone skeet on Blue Sky yesterday. Skeet is a text on Blue Sky. And what they said was that there are so many distractions happening every day. There's always some new news coming out, well, every hour out of Washington, D.C. And the undercurrent throughout is watch the money, watch the money, watch the money. Don't be distracted. Watch the money. Do you think that's a valid point of view?
Absolutely. And, you know, for a lot of us who are in the research space, it's actually part of our methodology to follow the money, to try and get a sense of this ecosystem, again, that has grown up around the use of tech at the border, to try and parse out, like, who are the players that we need to pay attention to? Where is the money going? What are the procurement contracts like? And why is there so little transparency?
Mm-hmm. How does this figure out, Ale, on the streets in Chicago and in the county, if you know? I mean, how much transparency is there about the technology that's being used on that local level?
Yeah, I think, again, it's a bit of a mixed bag. One big thing that Chicago was able to accomplish in the past year was we were able to remove devices and auditory surveillance devices from a company called ShotSpotter. I think a lot of that came out of organizing and doing this research around large sums of money, you know, millions of dollars the city was blowing on these devices. And these devices themselves weren't really effective at doing what they were claiming. They were claiming at detecting gunshots in the air. But what they were doing was they were increasing things like stopping and frisking activity, getting people, setting up these dragnets across the city, frequently just targeting Black, Brown, poor folks here. I think you know, to Petra's point, most of these technologies are really just following these major profit incentives. Again, the surveillance and the nexus of like surveillance and industry across the globe is maybe like in 2021, it was like $6.6 billion for that industry. And I'm sure it's much higher at this point. Mm-hmm. So I think now that we're having more discussions, at least in Chicago, around how our data is used, who it belongs to, how it's bought and sold, and how really what ends up incentivizing these pieces of technology to be deployed at the local level isn't this idea of like safety and service to community, but is actually just this much more extensive pull towards large profit margins. I think it makes it's becoming a lot more clear that what needs to happen is that this kind of market incentive needs to be removed. And then if these companies and these groups and so forth want to keep producing technologies that they may claim is for public interest, I think it would be excellent to see that tested when the profit incentive starts diminishing. But we just don't see that. So I think that's sort of the trajectory and how things have been playing out here. I think it's more experimenting around that and understanding how money's been flowing across the city.
You know, I'm putting myself in so far as I can, Ali. I'm putting myself in the feet of someone who is afraid of being caught and deported, whether they're breaking the law or not by being here, whether they're a tax-paying person or not. And I'm thinking that my opportunity to educate myself about data use and possibly even help to push back against that might be slim to none. You know, I'm busy protecting myself. I'm busy protecting my kids. How much can one depend on or ask of the people that they are helping to protect to take part in learning about this, to take part in resisting it? Or is this really something that falls more on the people who are working to protect them?
Absolutely, that's an excellent question. I think so. I think there's a reality that this kind of domain, these like highly technical database areas, they have a sort of intimidating mystique to them. But I think regardless of that, to the second part of your question, this really isn't. I don't think it should be on the individual. I don't think the onus of protection should be on the individual. I mean, there are certainly some things we're doing now because this is a moment of crisis, and I think there are small practical things people can do, right? Like maybe use encrypted messaging if you want to say something that you're afraid could be criminalized. Maybe be careful about what you're sharing on social media, and practice just some basic data hygiene. And we do a lot of like trainings around that sort of thing. But at the end of the day, these sorts of issues have really just followed this long trajectory of expanding a massive infrastructure that shouldn't have been here, which I would argue shouldn't have been here. And then having a situation in which an extremely aggressive, and I'd also argue malicious government and state has now full access to these kinds of tools. I think Petra made a really great point earlier that a lot of this surveillance apparatus, at least in the US, was expanded under Dems. And it's, I think we saw a lot of that here in Chicago, but now that we're in a sort of situation where it can be leveraged for purposes of criminalizing migrant populations, mobile populations, it's just being used to a level of cruelty that isn't necessarily new, but is accelerated and amplified because of these new tools.
And Petra, that makes me wonder about trying to divorce those two elements. We talk about how entrenched money is in this system, and we talk about how it has actually, this technology has actually reinforced and enhanced the racist issues that are behind it. I'm wondering if there is a practical way to even imagine divorcing enforcement from monetized technology or to create more oversight. Something along those lines. What would you visualize as a fairer way to do all this?
That's a good question, and it's a question that keeps me up at night, you know, as someone who kind of toggles between the research world and the law world. You know, I think we're in a moment where there just are inadequate laws and governance around technology at large and border technology specifically. So I think number one, we definitely need more law, we need more guardrails, and maybe even a ban on some of this technology. Although, you know, how realistic that is, that's an open question. I mean, we can't even agree on banning autonomous weapons in war. How are we going to agree on border technology, right? And so sometimes I get a little bit pessimistic when I think about what the next step could be. But I think maybe one way forward is to look at local action. And Ali's interventions today are really reminding us of how important it is to go to the ground, go to communities, go to municipalities and cities and see what's happening there. There's been a number of cities, for example, that have banned biometric mass surveillance on their streets and said, no, we don't want facial recognition here. We are not okay with this in our communities. That to me is pretty powerful. So I think really what we need is perhaps, you know, an understanding that we need more law, we need more governance, but we also need local action and local support for communities to feel empowered to stand up for their rights and say, well, this is not exactly what we are for, and we don't welcome this type of technology in our streets and in our houses and our communities.
Well, one angle you've been monitoring, Petra, is since Trump was elected, is how his pressure on other countries might be affecting their immigration policies, since we're looking internationally now. Talking about Canada and Mexico, where the tariffs are in flux, China moved in retaliation just yesterday. So what kind of actions have Mexico and Canada taken in the 3 months that concern you? And I'm looking, for example, Canada now has a mobile app to track permanent residents, foreign nationals, and refugee claimants. They pledged to spend roughly $1 billion on border security because of Trump's threat of tariffs. They've got a facial recognition app. So what else are you seeing, Canada, Mexico, China, that are concerning you along the same lines?
Yeah, there's a lot of concern because ultimately these issues are global, and what the United States does has reverberations not only in neighboring countries like Canada and Mexico, but globally speaking as well. You know, the Canada response is an interesting one because our research lab sits in Canada, and so this is something that's literally close to home for us. And even after the election, there was already a ramping up of just questions about, well, how is Canada going to respond to these immigration changes that are coming? And lo and behold, like you said, Canada proudly unveiled in December that they wanted to increase the border budget by $1.3 billion. And that includes different surveillance, data gathering, drones, things like that. In response to then threatened and then realized tariffs. And you know, Mexico similarly has been implicated for years now in terms of, for example, data sharing between Mexico and the United States, again, without conversations around what this is doing to data protection and people's human rights that are impacted by this. And again, a threat of tariffs. And then there's this kind of bowing down to the kind of conversations that are leading the way, which are led by the United States. But globally speaking, you know, there's also, I think, this normalization of tech and that kind of conflation of the private sector in all of this. And unfortunately, seeing what's happening in America, I think we're going to likely see echoes of that in other jurisdictions, too.
Ale, let's go back to you in Chicago and talk about the whole job of triaging when it comes to activists or resistance groups, nonprofits. Throughout this series, we've talked to a number of groups that are working overtime, working overnight, working 24/7 to help immigrant populations, to help shield them, to help educate them. And I'm just wondering about, with you, what are you seeing in terms of your abilities to keep moving forward, educating people about the technology, letting them know about WhatsApp, letting them know about Signal, trying to help them understand the problems with facial recognition? How much time can you actually devote to that?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I don't remember when the last time I got a full 8 hours of sleep was. But I think one of the key features of effective resistance is it's not so much that you're helping people, but it's you're working with people to disseminate knowledge as quickly as possible. So I think at least a LPL, one of the approaches that we take, you might frequently hear organizers refer to train the trainer based pedagogy, mm-hmm. Which is really like you work with folks that already have some sort of active role within their communities to understand an issue enough so that they can go back to their community and then also do the teaching themselves. So it's sort of like you want to position the sharing of knowledge in a way where it's not really centralized, but it's distributed. So I think that's been it's been something that's worked really well in Chicago in a lot of ways. I think that's part of what made the Know Your Rights information travel so rapidly. I think the city just has a long history of organizing and organizing that's meant to distribute information pretty quickly. I think if we were to depend on, like, you know, a collection of nonprofits or organizing groups or just like informal collectives, that's not enough. I don't think that's ever been enough for an effective liberatory politic and praxis. I think the reality of it is we need to distribute information as quickly as possible, work together to try to keep true statements flowing and fact check when there might be misinformation or disinformation occurring, because that also has been happening a lot throughout this moment. And also just think about, unfortunately, right, I think there's a sort of an escalation of tactics, because at this moment, I think at the very beginning of the show, I said at this phase of these raids and ICE and DHS activity, I think we saw a lot of success with Know Your Rights, but I think without falling into some sort of a pit of fear, I do think there are situations in which Know Your Rights trainings might just become more ineffective, and there has to be more community conversation around what we do in those moments.
That's Alejandro Ruiz Esparza, co-director of the Lucy Parsons Lab in Chicago. Ale, thank you so much.
Thank you. This is great.
Glad to have you. Petra, thank you as well. She is a lawyer and anthropologist specializing in migration and human rights, associate director of the Refugee Law Lab at York University, and author of an important book to this conversation, The Walls Have Eyes, Surviving Migration in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. You can learn more about her at PetraMolnar.com. Petra, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, and I neglected to mention, you can follow Ali's work at LucyParsonsLab.com. If you've missed any part of today's show or you want to check out Your Call's previous show, visit kalw.org/yourcall. Email us with your questions, your comments, and your show suggestions, yourcall@kalw.org. On our next show, we're going to be talking about Hooked. That's a documentary that explains how the same channels that bring your mind into alliance with cults are being used to bring you into alliance with marketing. It's going to be a fascinating conversation tomorrow. Tune in at 10 o'clock for that. And we want to thank also, we have Andrew Stelzer helping produce today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. And I'm Angie Cuero, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Thank you for tuning in to Your Call.
President Trump is making deep cuts to federal climate programs. What does this mean for state and local clean energy and conservation efforts? Join KALW and local climate experts tonight at 6 p.m. for the Bay Agenda, Climate Action in an Uncertain Environment. You're invited, and it's free. Join the conversation this evening at 220 Montgomery Street in downtown San Francisco. Learn more at kalw.org.
KALW is powered by our members, including James M. Kelly of Berkeley, Lisa Marks of San Francisco, Leo Gasteiger of Vallejo, and Eduardo Martinez in Pasadena. Join them and join us. And thank you for your support. We're at kalw.org and click donate. This is 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area. Heard around the world on kalw.org and on the KALW app. It's 11 o'clock.